Thank you. That's good. Oh, sorry, I didn't know I was on. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. My name is Sean Acor, and I'm so nervous I actually wrote that down in my lecture notes. I'm excited today because Tal has given me the opportunity to talk today about the intersection between humor and positive psychology. I think it's because Tal recognized that the important topic of humor had seemed to slip through the proverbial cracks in the sign readings and in the syllabus. And if you're interested in these proverbial cracks or were unaware that there were assigned readings or a syllabus for this course, a copy can be obtained on the course website. I'm excited this morning because I feel like I have a lot of things to say, mostly about myself, some about the course, but mostly about myself. And one of the things I realized in writing this lecture is that it's much harder to write a lecture on humor that people expect to be funny than it is to give a lecture on a topic that people expect to be boring. That is, unless you expected me to be boring this morning, in which case I'm well on my way. So in keeping with my promise of more of me and of less of you in this course, I think it's important at this point in the lecture to add into what must surely be your very copious notes from this morning's lecture so far, that I originally came here as an undergrad, studied English, went to the Divinity School, studied Christian and Buddhist ethics, and this fall I'm going to be starting up a PhD program in psychology. Now, the reason I mention this is because I'm narcissistic, and because all the things I'm going to be talking about today are a synthesis of these ideas. I'll be taking the ideas of mindfulness from the psychology lab of Ellen Langer, ideas of transcendence from the Divinity School, concepts of wit and humor from the aptly named English course Wit and Humor, and stemming out of an all-abiding love for all things through Stewie Griffin. I'll be referring to studies and ideas and arguments that could be used as springboards for your own ideas in your positive psychology projects that you're going to be doing, if you're interested in doing anything about humor. Today, we're going to talk about a couple of things. We're going to go through different explanations of humor. We're going to talk about a specific type of humor, mindful humor, which I'll be doing and discussing and defining today. We'll look at the MIBs, the mental and interior benefits that are caused by positive psychology and humor. We'll look at the positive social benefits in the dating world, in the political realm, in the business world. We'll look and take pragmatic steps to increasing our humor. And then we'll end up talking about what I feel like is the most powerful and important part about humor. Well, enough about that and more about me. Now, I'm sure that you're sitting out there, I know what you're thinking as you're reading my PowerPoint slides. You're thinking to yourself, I think I'm going to name my first three kids Sean, regardless of gender. And what is it that made Sean interested in psychology in the first place? Well, I'll tell you. And just as Tal said, it's very important for us to make good on the promises that we say we're going to do, like he did when he put on his pink shirt and did this little turn on the catwalk up here. I actually practiced something similar to that in my own room, but realized I have the Derek Zoolander problem. I can't turn left. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just do the dance from the end of Napoleon Dynamite. And I practiced it for months and performed in front of my very close friends yesterday. And they offered the helpful criticism that I dance worse than Elaine Bennis. Thank you for that comment, my friends. So instead, I decided just to tell you a story. When I was between the ages of 5 to 7, I fell in love with every babysitter I had. And every babysitter I had came from my dad's classes at Baylor University, where he was a psychology professor. So I thought to myself, well, Sean, what is the best way that you could maximize the time that you spend with these lovely ladies? And I thought, well, one of the ways is to become part of their world. I got this idea from Ariel in The Little Mermaid. So I decided that one of the ways I could do this would be to participate in one of the psych studies my dad was doing. Well, he loved the idea and was very excited about it and brought me to his class, and I got to stand up in front of the entire class while I sit down because he hooked me up to a brainwave machine, which tests your brainwaves. So they put electrodes on your head. There are four of them. And he was going to test the brainwave machine. But my dad was so excited that his son really wanted to be part of his research that in his excitement, he forgot to ground the wire. So what happened was, as I was sitting there in front of all my future girlfriends, instead of, I don't know what I was thinking, I thought the electrodes would actually help somehow. Sitting there, because the wire wasn't grounded, all of a sudden I started shaking. I was like, "Dad, turn it off!" I was so upset. He flipped it off really fast, and people started to snicker a little bit, and I ripped off my electrodes and walked off to the side of the class and turned back and opened the door and said, "Dad, you ruined my chances!" Which was true. I never did get with any of those girls. So what makes us laugh at a story like that, a story of awkwardness and pain? Some of us are thinking to themselves, why are some of these people laughing at it? Is it because I primed you that this is a lecture on humor and not a lecture on beloved acts of child abuse? Or is it because we're in this room, we're in this space, if there was just one person out in the audience, as opposed to 800,000 of you, that would that affect the humor at all? And it's interesting, you can barely hear the laughter up here. I know I gave two lectures for the leadership course the past 2 days, or over the past week, and you can't actually hear the laughter upstage. It's weird, you can't even hear it on the video for the course. My only explanation about how that could possibly be occurring is maybe the acoustics of Sanders are eating the laughter, so feel free to laugh as loud as possible today, but think about how your decision to laugh was based upon the fact that there are multiple people in this room, and the room size has effects. Well, I'm happy to report that just hearing that story, even if you didn't laugh at it, just being in the same room with people who are laughing, that you have just become happier and healthier, as all the research studies that I'm going to be talking about today indicate. It is clear that humor has a real and visceral effect upon us. But why is it important that we actually study this? Well, studying humor has actually three main problems. One of the first problems is everyone finds something different funny. For example, I love Family Guy, and it sounds like a lot of people out there love Family Guy as well. I showed a clip to my parents of Family Guy. It was the Hiroshima clip, if anyone knows which one that one is. Tastefully done. If they were laughing on the inside, they certainly weren't expressing it on the outside. I definitely didn't feel very validated. I think the problem is because humor is so defined by the context we're in, by who we are, where we live in the world, what our moods are that we're feeling. And every act and every attempt to try and define humor seems to slip through our fingers and we're unable to do so, partly because of what's referred to as the dead frog problem. Thank you for Harrison for pointing this out to me. Can you actually study humor and it still be humor? If you've taken the Went Humor course, you know this problem well. The problem is, the dead frog problem is that the more you dissect a frog, the faster it seems to die. So too, the same is true with humor. Think about it. Even if it's true that there are salutary benefits of humor, that it makes us closer, it makes us bond, it makes us more attractive for romantic partners, it makes us do better in the business world. Even if all this is true, maybe it doesn't matter. Because maybe, aren't just some people funny and some people aren't? Does that mean that some people are able to maximize and get the benefits from humor and laughter, where the rest of us are bereft of these benefits? I think we're gonna be able to overcome all three of those problems today. My argument today is simple, yet extraordinarily brilliant. I argue that humor is a permeable lens through which we view the world. Humor is a way of mindfully perceiving the world, analogous to peak experiences and flow, where an individual is aware of potentialities within a situation or an environment. These potentials can include the opportunity for positive change, that things are better now than the alternative, or just the fact that there is an alternative, that reality is not just one-dimensional. It's a way of viewing the world, the vagaries of the world, the ups and downs, in a mindful way, a way open to possibility instead of monotony, a way of looking at the world in an adaptive way instead of a maladaptive way in terms of inelasticity and rigidity. It is a special way of viewing reality that changes everything: our relations, our health, our hopes, our love lives, our lack of love lives, our lack of lives, our utter lack of friends, and the way we view conflict. We'll discuss all of these issues today. But before we can do so, we must first ground ourselves within the philosophies of humor. Just as in positive psychology, Tal began this class by talking about the humanistic tradition, so too we must talk about the two most fundamental aspects and critics of the concept of humor. These are both taken from the Whitney Humor class, which many of you have taken. I don't think just one of them is correct, but I think a synthesis of these critics is correct, so we'll go through them. The first is Sigmund Freud, whose unassailable, airtight logic on his opinions about everything will surely stand the test of time. Wrote a book called Jokes and the Relationship to the Unconscious, which, if you didn't read it for Whitney Humor, is an extremely painful book to read. For a man who's writing a book about what is funny, it's the largest collection of unfunny stories since Leviticus. Freud argues in this book that we have a model of consciousness. This model of consciousness starts when we're born with id impulses on the inside. These id impulses are sexual and violent in nature and desires that we wish to enact. We have an ego that forms around that, around the ages of 4 and 5, depending on who you're reading. And outside of that, you have something called the superego, which is the societal constraints upon the ego, which prevents those id impulses from coming out into society. What Freud argues is that humor itself is the socially acceptable envelope of couching those id desires and moving them out into the real world. For example, if I'm angry at somebody, if somebody does something to me that I don't like, society says that I can't hit them, right? I can't just punch them in the face. But what I am allowed to do socially is I'm allowed to make jokes or mock them or make fun of them, right? So I'm still able to get those same id impulses out, but in a socially acceptable way. This explains a lot. This explains why on first dates we oftentimes joke about physicality before we can actually be physical, because it's a social way, a socially acceptable way of broaching the subject of physicality before we can. Or think about a comedian, think about somebody like Chris Rock. If you listen to the audience of Chris Rock, there are people that are cheering as well as laughing. And part of what's going on there is that they're feeling a release both of frustrations that they feel that Rock voices, but also a lot of them are there on dates. Also, finally, this explains why we have humor that's aimed at political figures. If I'm frustrated at a way the government's being run in a certain way, I have no recourse. I can't actually do anything about that. Aside from voting, I can't do anything to affect that. But what I can do is I can make jokes, right? So I can still release those frustrations in a socially acceptable form. The other critic that we need to talk about is Henri Bergson. Bergson, much like Maslow from this course, argues that humans are on a developmental trajectory, and that every time while we're on this developmental trajectory, humor is used as a corrective. So every time we fall off of this trajectory, humor points out the fact that we have fallen off and provides the punishment that's supposed to be used to corral us and move us back towards human development. I'll give you some examples. I've been meeting with you guys for coffee or reading your response papers, and here's a couple examples of how humor is a corrective. For example, if you're saying hello across the street to you're out of your league crush, and you're waving at them, and you walk right into a parking meter while you're doing so, we laugh at people like this to correct you, to make you more mindful of the situation around you. Or, for example, if someone is angry, if somebody makes a social blunder, for example, like leaving a scandalous junk dial voicemail message for their boyfriend on their boyfriend's father's work line. We laugh to separate ourselves from those mistakes and to help those people come back into a human developmental trajectory. Or if you're standing outside of Winthrop and you're surrounded by a group of guys that you like and a bird poops on your head, well, we laugh to make you more aware of birds. Now, one of the people that's perfected this idea, that has run with this, a brilliant psychologist by the name of Dale Sturtevant, runs with this idea of humor being used as a corrective. But this morning, we'll watch.
I'm Dale Sturtevant. I've been raising dogs since I was 6, and nothing has brought me more joy or more sheer frustration than training a puppy. With a very young pup, correcting problem behavior can be especially maddening. And like you, I've probably tried all the tricks. Screaming myself hoarse, starving them, locking them in a closet for days on end, or just beating them without mercy. But after my 3rd arrest and court-ordered anger management counseling, I learned to channel my rage into an effective, non-violent puppy training tool. It's called dissing your dog. How to train your puppy with mockery and verbal humiliation. You see, dogs are much more intuitive than we give them credit for. They know when they're the butt of ridicule, and when they misbehave, a well-placed sarcastic comment or cutting remark can work wonders where a rolled-up newspaper fails. Whatever your puppy's behavior problem, I guarantee I can help you fix it. Problems like jumping on furniture. Oh, no, 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 Humphrey, don't get up. Why don't you just stay there and relax? After all, you did put in a long day of work at a demanding, high-stress job. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's me. Now I remember. I'm the one with the job. You're the one who lies around the house all day in a pool of your own slobber. Accidents in the house. Hey, Walter, thanks for your help with the new off-white sofa. Everybody agrees that dump you left there was the perfect accent. So good job. Oh, and by the way, Milton Berle called. He wants his bladder control back.
That's it. Good dog.
Fussy eating habits.
Oh, right, Margaret. You wanted prime rib. Here's the deal. The Palm wasn't taking reservations. I really want to try Morton's because I understand they have a new chef. So for now, let's just go with the Alpo, okay? I know it's not your first choice, but keep in mind, you're a dog.
Tears come to my eyes as we view this modern-day Marva Collins. I think what we need is a synthesis of these two critics. We can't take just Bergson's idea that humor is a corrective, because there's a lot of humor that we have that isn't aimed at correcting anyone in our society. In fact, I think part of the frustration we feel sometimes, and we may even feel it in a positive psychology course, is the disjunct between our ideal self and the self we are now. That frustration between being where we are and the developmental trajectory to the point where we want to be. And when we realize that we're falling off, Freud's humor, Freud's idea of humor, starts to filter in the sense that Bergson says that we laugh to correct us back on the developmental trajectory. But the fact that we are on this developmental trajectory causes us stress. And that stress is relieved by humor, according to Freud. So why did these critics help? Nice segue. One of the first ways that I think that helps is that we start to realize that humor itself is a lens. Much like optimism and peak experiences, humor is a cognitive approach, a way of seeing the world in a way that we're able to transcend its monotony or its suffering. Now, my argument today is going to stem from the initial question, the simple question we can ask, the first one we should be asking when we look at humor, is why some people are funnier than other people. Why do some people see humor in a situation where others recoil or become upset? What kind of person could laugh at an embarrassing or awkward moment or a breaking of a social rule instead of becoming clammed up, becoming rigid, and not finding it funny? We can test this today. Let's watch a scene.
Oh, I grew up in Manhattan.
Really?
I
Part of what's going on here is the idea of, can we actually laugh at the breaking of a social rule such as this? In social psychology, one of the very first things we did in the course is we asked the students to break up into pairs. In these pairs, they were supposed to go out into the world, which was supposed to be separate from the social psychology course itself, and to find out, they were supposed to break social rules. They could break any of the rules. They could cut a line at Starbucks to see what the effect would be of breaking a social rule. Some of the other examples that you could think about would be lying down in an elevator, or if you're in an elevator, slowly turn around and face the person next to you. Cut in line at Starbucks, haggle for a price of a coop, ask for free samples of things you can't get free samples of, like a large burrito at Felipe's. One girl in the girls' locker room decided to take a shower at a shower head that was already being used. Another guy went around telling his team that he was tired and asked if they could soap up his back. Tell somebody that you need money when you're standing in line because you don't want to break your 20. Or talk to people incessantly in the bathroom stalls. In all of these cases, you could actually learn a lot about yourself. And the reason you could is because you start to recognize whether or not you would laugh and be able to enjoy this, or whether you break down. I can't actually break a social rule. And part of the way that people were able to do that was in changing the way that they perceived of the breaking of the social rule. Think about this. We'll do a little thought experiment. I watch how an innocent, innocuous fact can suddenly be transformed into something that's slightly funny, merely by shifting the way that our brains are evaluating it. So for example, sometimes I cut my toenails. No one laughs. Sometimes I cut my toenails in sanders. There's an additional step which suddenly makes it interesting. Since no one laughed, I said interesting instead of funny. Alcohol makes you drunk, even before you teach a section. Someone told me at a bar they slept with my mom. I told my dad he was drunk. I sometimes have problems speaking English. I'm the president of the United States. In these simple cases, the framework for evaluation was the differentiating factor. Therefore, there is a specific lens, a very specific lens, which changes fact into funny. There's an idea called the alpha and the beta press. The alpha press is the objective constraints upon reality. This is what we're all experiencing equally today. We're all sitting in sanders. We're breathing the same air. We have the same lights, the same situation. Unless you're watching this at home on video. The other one is beta press. Beta press is the subjective control of reality. This is a way that is all different. We're all experiencing the same objective reality, and yet we're feeling very different things. You may be very tired, or you may be very bored. I'm very nervous. You may be comatose. Any of these is possible with the beta press, because it's the subjective way that we view the reality that we're actually experiencing. Now, much of positive psychology is actually changing the beta press, that we can change the way that we're subjectively construing the world, whether it be through viewing things more positively, with self-esteem, or with optimism, or with flow. The outcome will be altered for the better. The same is true for humor. To prove his point about the beta press, Tal talked about how he could take the same objective situation and tell it with just a fact or with an optimistic spin. The same exact thing is true not only in optimism, but in humor. I'll show you. So on the one hand, I can tell you a story that I contracted a disease, that I refused treatment and was in so much pain that I almost was not able to breathe, and they had to put me on so much medicine, that they had to put me on medicine stronger than codeine because it wasn't strong enough. Another way of telling the exact same story. When I was a sophomore, I somehow contracted mono. When I contracted mono, I pretended, well, I don't know if you've taken this in your sections, but there's something called the locus of control, where you feel like power resides in your life. And I had an extremely high internal locus of control, which made me think that my mind was stronger than my body. And so I decided that although UHS, by the third time I had gone in, when they lost the other two blood samples, they told me that I had mono. I told them that no, in fact, I did not have mono. And I told myself this, and I went hiking in the White Mountains and couldn't make it all the way to the top. I played IM football and almost ruptured my spleen. Finally, my throat started swelling because I wasn't taking care of myself. And at first I couldn't eat, I couldn't swallow, but I knew from studies that you can go for like 2 weeks without eating. So I knew this wasn't that big a problem because I clearly didn't have mono. And so then my throat started constricting more, and so I had trouble talking. So a pretty girl would walk by and she'd say, "Hey, Sean," and I'd be like, which didn't help. And then my throat started constricting more, so I couldn't swallow, which means I couldn't drink. Well, I knew you can last for 3 days, so I knew I had another 3 days to figure out what was that nothing was ailing me. Finally, when my throat started closing so much that I couldn't breathe, I walked over to UHS shaking and entered myself into Stillman, unable to pronounce my own name. So they immediately put me on IVs, and they set me up, and they had to give me some medicine that was stronger. I don't know what they gave me, but whatever it was good. Because I remember I was watching a baseball game on television, and while I was sitting there, the nurse kept walking in and out. And at one point, she just saw me, and I'm just staring there at the TV in this drug-induced haze, just like staring at it. And all of a sudden, somebody hits a pop fly, and I dove out of my bed head first in order to catch it, because it was clear no one else was going to catch it. The nurse looked on in horror at what just happened, because I dove face first into the floor. Meanwhile, I'm hiding the ball in my pretty pink mitt because I was sure that she was going to take both of them away from me. This is the same story, but when the retelling of it, I could have told you in a sense of disease and of pain, instead of telling it in a way that's humorous and allows us to find, just by introducing different sides, different parts, different ways of viewing the objective reality, we've changed it from fact into funny. The last thing that makes it difficult in terms of this lens is that we're affected by affect. What that means is our lens is very much shaped by the emotions we feel. If we're tired, we don't laugh as much. Some people argue, for example, if something terrible or tragic has happened to us, our lens becomes myopic in the sense that we can't see the humor in a particular situation. If we're tired, tiredness or fatigue causes cataracts on these lenses. Sometimes we're in the perfect mood to watch movies like Napoleon Dynamite. Other times we realize that there are scripts about when we can be funny and when we can't. First dates are a great time to showcase your humor, although people stop cracking jokes at places like funerals or in front of complete strangers. There is a scientific measure for determining our humor mood, and I call it Sean's super scientific test for determining humor mood. I've debated about whether or not to show this, and it's a funny commercial from Saturday Night Live, and it proves my point specifically. It breaks and crosses several lines, but part of what we want to do is we want to test. You can test to see what the lens is that you're actually viewing the objective reality, which we're all experiencing the same alpha press, or we will be when we watch this video. Also, I thought it'd be interesting because I know many of you are considering looking at ethical ways of dealing with, to make geriatrics lives better. And I thought that this was a beautiful and respectful way of doing so.
Kids, go ahead. I want to have a talk with your old grandma. You're still having control problems, aren't you?
I just don't feel confident, Harvey.
Come with me. I'll let you in on a little secret. Here we are. It's Oops, I Crap My Pants.
Oops, I Crap My Pants. I've heard of those. Do they work?
Oops, I Crap My Pants outperformed every bladder and bowel control product on the market today. Here, let me show you. Now imagine this pitcher of iced tea is really a gallon of your feces. Now see how its super thick fluff filter allows for maximum absorbency without leaking.
I'm impressed. Oops, I Crap My Pants can hold a lot of dung.
And get this. Oops, I Crap My Pants are biodegradable. Now, that's good for the environment.
Say, how do you know so much about Oops, I Crap My Pants?
I'm wearing them, and I just did.
Thanks, Oops, I Crap My Pants.
Visit your local pharmacist and just say, Oops, I Crap My Pants, from Procter & Gamble.
It's terrible, absolutely terrible. I apologize for showing it. Part of what I wanted to test is there a certain type of personality that lends us to being able to laugh at something like this, something that's so silly, absurd, bathroom humor? Is there something embedded within, deep within our core that allows us to do this? Now, there's some humor critics that argue that people that laugh at things like this is the Fishers, they argue that certain people are drawn to such humor because they had unhappy childhoods. I disagree. I think that humor is a lens which allows us to view the world in the most adaptive way possible, so adaptive that it might be evolutionarily selected for, which I'll get to in just a second. The last part about this lens is that humor is a lens for viewing the world in a mindful way. Ellen Langer is one of the world's leading experts on mindfulness theory, and she's here at Harvard. Mindfulness is an awareness caused by being present in the situation, by being aware of the potentials. Let me say that one more way. It's an awareness caused by being present in a situation, by recognizing the potentials in an environment. Mindfulness, according to Langer, is a spring of creativity, of increased productivity, and creates compassion. In her new book on becoming an artist, she outlines several roadblocks to mindfulness, such as evaluation, pre-programmed responses, critiques. These are all things that Henri Bergson says that humor attempts to correct. Bergson, remember, argues that humor is a corrective, and what it's trying to do is identify and challenge the mechanical parts of our society that have become encrusted upon the adaptive or upon the living. Humor, if it is a lens for viewing the world in a mindful way, is an attempt to call attention to the ways in which we've become mechanical or become unaware, ways to which we've become absurd, what Bergson calls absent-mindedness, and what Langer would call mindlessness. But I think humor is even more than this, and this is where I filter in some ideas from the Divinity School. I think that humor, well, Peter Berger actually first argues that humor helps us transcend the constraints of this world and to change our cognition. I want to argue for a connection between Berger and Maslow. Maslow, remember, argues that peak experiences are times when, for a moment, just for a moment, we experience self-actualization, where we're all striving to. These peak experiences are valuable because it reminds us we're not trapped in a world of being, but in a world of becoming. The same is true with humor. In the world of humor, there are no consequences. We are bonded in a sense of unity. We feel happy even at the sufferings and the vicissitudes of life. The more we visit the world of humor, just like a peak experience or a religious experience, the more we're reminded the world is not the only way it can be. That is not the end of the story. Now, that is not to suggest that we want to live in the world of humor all the time. I think we'd all get bored living in the apartment of Jerry Seinfeld. But Seinfeld is a good example because it's an example of a show that takes the ordinary, the mundane, the crappy things that happen to us in normal everyday life, such as hitting a squirrel on the road, or not knowing a girl's name after you make out, or not liking muffin bottoms. Made the ordinary extraordinary, interesting, and thus meaningful and bonding. Perhaps meditation, which tries to make us more mindful of the ordinary to make it extraordinary, is much closer to humor than we normally think about. Now, before moving on, well, I want to talk about one more thing. It's that Harvey Sachs also argues that we humor is a momentary suspension of reality. In this moment, the reason we don't feel consequences is because reality is momentarily changed. We momentarily get a glimpse at another possibility for reality, and that reality does not have to be viewed from just one set of eyes, but can be viewed through a different lens, that our eyes are the keys to transforming reality. Reality, then, is impinged by only our creativity, rather than reality impinging us. Now, a lot of you might be thinking to yourself, wait a minute, Sean, that's all and well that you're talking about this and changing the emphasis in our lives to the humorous, to the life-giving aspects, but there really is a reality which objectively sometimes just sucks. At some point, alpha press, the objective constraints, trumps the beta press. I'm not sure how valid that assumption is, that alpha press does trump beta press, but I would respond with two comments. The first is to connect it to the idea of the Stockdale paradox, which, remember, says that we need to be realistic, but also we need to be recognizing that we can have a hope for a reality that is different from the reality that we currently have. The second argument comes from Life is Beautiful, which I haven't actually seen, but I think it makes my point perfectly. In it, so just go watch it. It's about a father and a son who are in what I would believe all of us would consider to be one of the worst alpha presses you can be in, a Nazi concentration camp. The father, throughout the course of the movie, touchingly tries to make the camp humorous for the son, like it's a game, because the son can't quite understand it yet. He tries to couch the evil as a fun challenge. He mocks the marching of the Nazi soldiers. He tries to make hide-and-go-seek something fun and enjoyable. The rebuttalist would argue, that's precious, but the father's sense of humor did not stop the Nazi bullets. Yes, in reality, the father was not saved, but the son, because of the humorous mindset, survived and was spared some of the emotional trauma because of the reality that the father created. In other words, do not so quickly assume that only the objective constraints of reality are the only reality. Our cognitive mindsets, our lens, are also part of reality and are quite effective ones, as we're going to demonstrate. I want to shift us to the concept of the MIBs, which are the mental interior benefits. These are the positive effects that humor has upon us. These are the interior ones, and we'll also talk about the ones that I think are really fun as well, are the pro-social ones. The first is that you may have heard already that laughter is the best medicine, and you may have heard of The Deep Thought by Jack Handy, which says something along the lines of, Father always said that laughter was the best medicine, which probably explains why many of us died of tuberculosis. What humor does is it activates the parasympathetic response. Our autonomic nervous system, our involuntary responses, change in accordance with the stresses we feel in our life. When that occurs, it activates the sympathetic response, which is our fight or flight, which dump chemicals, which are poisons, basically, into our body. I say that they're poisons only because they're catabolic, which means they tear down the body. The parasympathetic is the flip side of this. It's the process that changes our body after the fight or flight. It calms us down, we breathe easier, our heartbeats become slower, and that's exactly what humor does for us. It causes and restores the changes that have been caused by all the stresses that have occurred so far in our lives. This has a lot of effects. First of all, even in small doses, psychology research has shown that humor increases the immune system. In a study done by Kamada with people suffering from bronchial asthma, he exposed some of these individuals to a dust mite, which they have allergic reaction to. I don't know how they got that passed, but this is what they did. And so later, once they recognized that these people, yes, did in fact have allergic reactions to these dust mites, they had them come back at a later date. Then they split them into two groups. And in one group, they gave them the dust mite, and again, they had the allergic reaction. In the other group, they told them a funny joke, a single joke, and then exposed them a few moments later to the dust mite. And what they found is that single joke changed the response. It dramatically decreased the allergic reaction to the dust mite. That's a single joke. Imagine an entire Family Guy episode. Also, humor increases pain tolerance, if you're ever thinking of mixing them. A German psychologist named Zweier, of course, leave it to the Germans to test pain tolerance relating to humor, had a control group where they had somebody watch a serious video, and then they had another group where they watched a humorous video. While they were doing this, they had one of their hands immersed in extremely cold water, the typical test for pain tolerance. The longer you can keep it in, the longer your pain tolerance. What they found is the individuals who were watching the humorous video were able to keep their hands in the ice-cold water for longer than the ones watching a serious video. Now, that might not be all that surprising to you, although it is extraordinarily interesting. An additional interesting part about it is that the effects, the after effects, lasted for 20 minutes. So you could have them watch a humorous video, wait 20 minutes, then perform the experiment, and it still had the same effect of decreasing or of increasing the pain tolerance. Humor also decreases stress and increases remission rates. There's a lot of different studies from a lot of different sources about every different type of disease that humor cures. That's why we get movies like Patch Adams. And one, which I thought was really interesting, was Chapel in Zealand, where they tested individuals that had testicular cancer. And what they found is the individuals who were able to find humor either in their situation or self-deprecating humor or in their condition in the sense that they felt like that there was some way that they could move beyond momentarily in the form of humor, that increased the remission rates and was one of the key determiners between difference in remission rates between patients with testicular cancer. It also has a ton of positive social effects. The benefits of humor are not limited to just the internal. I wish to talk about these social effects as well. There's something very interpersonal and camaraderie building about humor. We know and notice that we laugh more at Saturday Night Live, if we laugh at it at all, when we're in a group of other people. We laugh more when we're around other people. And it's sometimes it only takes one person laughing to cause a spread. It's extremely contagious. When they talk about this in Win Humor, they actually had to shut down some schools in Africa sometimes because of laughing epidemics that occur. We can try that when Tal returns. So I want to show you a clip which I think is hilarious, and it fits exactly in this point and is more fun if you actually try not to laugh at it, because that's exactly what the actors are trying to do. So take this less as a humor skit for you and as if you're observing a situation that's occurring between a group of people and the group dynamics that occur.
We did it, gang! We pulled it off! A family reunion at Disney! What about you guys? First thing I'm gonna do is I'm gonna ride that haunted elevator thingy. It drops you straight down!
This is my dream come true. I mean, I'm totally serious. Tigger hugged me at the door and I thought I was gonna cry.
I guess Roy isn't doing as well as they first thought. What? Who's Roy? Roy of Siegfried and Roy? He was attacked by his own tiger and suffered devastating injuries.
So, hey, who wants to go on Space Mountain with me?
I want to see the Country Bear Jamboree.
I'm going to go to every country in Epcot and greet them in their own native language. Hola, konnichiwa, hi.
You guys hear about that train explosion in North Korea? Media is so sensitive there, so secretive. never know how many people perished.
Who's ready for Mickey Wumpus?
I just made eye contact with Pluto, and he's coming over here.
Pluto!
Pluto! Pluto! Pluto! Oh my god, I'm hugging Pluto. I'm at Disney World, and I'm hugging Pluto. Somebody take a picture.
Oh,
well, you guys, Disney World really is fun. It makes me feel like a kid again. I mean, the time before my 2-year stint at Children's. Although the biggest drawback to working in a theme park is that you must live under constant fear of deadly terrorist attacks.
Pluto, wait, where are you going?
That costume on, he's probably in the early stages of heat stroke.
Fraley did some research on interpersonal relationships and how humor actually affects us when we're in groups. What they found, Fraley studied mostly first encounters and the bondage that occurs during those experiences. They found that they put individuals in these first experiences in a non... He found that when he threw two strangers into a non-humorous situation versus a humorous situation, those put in the humorous situation, like doing something extremely awkward, which made them look ridiculous, the respondents claimed to feel much higher levels of intimacy and bonding with the other person than they did in one which was goal-oriented, and they actually accomplished the goal. This is why blind dates and bars are the best times to flash out your humor, because it's one of the fastest ways to leap intimacy levels. Relatedly, Bippus did research on dating and found that the participants rate humor as being a very high potential priority in a mate. This was a worldwide study. And it's let me just give you two thought experiments. First is, how many in you here would either stop dating the person that you're dating currently or not date somebody if you found out that they were not rich? Just raise your hand. Okay. How many people in here, if you found out that the person you're dating, if you didn't discover it at this point, or if you were just meeting somebody for the first time, how many people would not date somebody if they had absolutely no sense of humor? Just raise your hand. Now, this is extraordinary. The reason this is extraordinary is that most of our theories of dating stem from evolutionary explanations. Right? We explain that men want a lot of girls because they're trying and tempting to spread their seed, whereas women want a single, like they try and focus on commitment because there's the idea that they're trying to curry resources for their egg. Right? These are evolutionary explanations that come from this, ideas of resource collecting. So why is it that wealth, which is a resource and allows you to get more resources, why is it then that humor seemed to be the one that we're actually highly valuing even more than wealth. Now, I'm sure some of you didn't raise your hands because it's a socially awkward question. But given that fact, I think that the majority of you would not date somebody if they didn't have a sense of humor. I think I have an explanation for it. My explanation for it is I think that we intuitively recognize that people that are humorous, when they're being humorous, we experience the health benefits from that. Decreased stress, increased social ability, increased ability to perform negotiations. And when we see this, when we see that they have humor, we relate it to ideas of self-esteem and the increased amount of resources we could carry, both based in terms of health and in terms of sociability. I also think it's interesting that when women say that they want somebody with, oftentimes when women say that when they want somebody with a sense of humor, what they mean is someone who makes them laugh. And when guys say it, oftentimes what they're meaning is they want someone who laughs at their jokes. This mindful humor, this lens, has other additional benefits, huge benefits in the pro-social realms. Study after study has found that humor bonds us together more than anything else. For example, in another study, if I just take a group of people that are supposed to perform a task and they fail, they experience no connection or antipathy towards each other. If they do a task together and they accomplish it, they feel higher levels of intimacy. If they do something and it fails, but in a humorous way, then they report the highest levels of intimacy. So what that means is, therefore, that if you're trying to pick somebody up at a party, don't start up a conversation with them or get them drinks. Rather, accidentally knock into them, pour your drinks all over them, and shout how awkward the situation is. You're assured some bondage after that witty repartee. Now, again, why is it that, think about it, employers surround themselves with people that have humor because it relates to ideas of self-esteem, but also increases the effect that you have in your negotiations and in your relationships with other people, which is why consulting groups for a lot of times look for people that are humorous in the same way we do and look for people in the political realm, which I'll shift to now. We look for people in the political realm to be funny. That's what I was trying to say. Now, if you think about it, humor and even cartoons pervade every aspect of our culture. More Americans know who Homer Simpson is than know who the Secretary of Defense is. I wrote Secretary of Defense because I didn't know as well. Doe is in the Oxford English Dictionary. I've literally watched 100 times more episodes of Family Guy than I have seen the news. And no one tapes the news and puts it on Kazaa or LimeWire, nor watches it over and over again, right? No one watches that, but Family Guy we can watch over and over again, or Simpsons, or Seinfeld, or Arrested Development. This is Daniel Wickberg's argument, or fits into it. Wickberg argues that we're stuck as individuals between a rock and a hard place. On the one side, society keeps becoming bigger and bigger, which means the individual becomes smaller and smaller. On the other hand, because we're becoming smaller and smaller, ideas of individuality becomes more and more important and salient. So while society presses down upon the individual, our philosophies and our desire to be individuals pushes up against us and we're crushed between them. According to Wickberg, humor is then as the lubricant between these two social forces. Wickberg goes on to say that actually most of the problems that we have in our political leaders is because many of them actually do not have a sense of humor. Many people, all of the presidential candidates after Nixon, will perform self-deprecating humor in their debates or in their speeches. We've heard Bush talk about the way he says things or the way he walks, right? In the same way, you get these leaders who are trying to show that they're more than one-dimensional. Wickberg argues that if we see somebody, and the reason to answer more of the question about why does we want somebody we would not want somebody who doesn't have a sense of humor at all, is because we see those people as being one-dimensional. They're frightening because they're unbudging, and in Wickberg's own words, psychotic. The political problems, think about it, a lot of our political problems, and a lot of even our romantic problems, think about your relationships, or if you like a relationship, are people being inflexible about their ideologies and the way that they see the world. Humor, on the other hand, is the ability to see multiplicity. Fortunately, two of our most cherished political leaders have such a deep understanding of the complex and multi-sided conflicts that face us. And I'll show those two people today. If you don't know them, they're George Bush and Tony Blair.
My love, there's only you in my life, the only thing that's bright.
My first love, you're every breath that I take, you're every step I make.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Before I get to the thing I'm most excited about today, I think the strongest power of humor, I want to mention briefly that there are ways we can actually increase our humor. I think it's irresponsible of me to go on without doing these. There are a lot of different ways to become humorous. You can look them up on the internet. I think that even anyone who does improv recognizes a clear connection between the work that they do and the ideas of mindfulness, where they have to be in a state where they don't hold on to things and to cling. Here are six steps I think that most of us can take if we're not in improv groups. The first, the funny gene, is just I don't think that there's anything genetic about being humorous, and no one does. So I don't know why I put that up there. The first one is that that you should journal stories that are funny and unique to you. This is changing your alpha press by changing your beta press, right? So you take a situation that occurred to you, then your life story, once you've looked at the humorous aspects of it, starts to change. In the same way, in the exact same way the gratitude journals do. Think about it, gratitude journals, the same thing happened in your day, the gratitude journals didn't change it, but it changes the way you conceive of them. Change the way that you conceive of your life stories, and you'll find ways to become more humorous and to see more humor as life progresses. Second, watch funny people, become an observer. They found in studies that people that watch the most comedy actually had the best sense of humor and were also the most funny themselves. And part of that is because they're picking up intuitively in the back of your mind, even if you leave Seinfeld on your room, you're picking up on the timing that's so important to humor. Third, ask the TQPRE. This is the two-question process. Why am I so funny, and why is it that others don't recognize this? Anytime a joke fails, just remind yourself of this, and remind yourself that a lot of your humor is based upon self-esteem. The fourth one is the permission to be subhuman. This is a book I'm writing in contrast to Tal's book, The Permission to Be Human, where we have to have the permission to be subhuman, to show clips about, oops, I crap my pants, or to do things that are awkward, to fall off the developmental trajectory momentarily, because it makes us recognize that we're all in the same boat together. Next, find a balance. Find ways and find places where you can actually be funny, think about them, and find ways and places where you actually shouldn't be funny. So part of becoming funny is recognizing where the lines are, which ones you're willing to cross, and which ones you aren't willing to cross. And the last one is go 100%. This is Jim Carrey's idea. He says that if you don't do a joke 100%, it fails. Jerry Seinfeld and Woody Allen lament that if you're telling a joke and you slip up on just one word, get back into it, the joke is suddenly not funny. It's just one word, it's the same joke, it's the same idea. What they found is the timing is so important, and what they also found is that going 100%, your self-esteem behind the joke is actually what makes it funny. Now for, I think, the greatest part and power of humor, and I think the most controversial one, but I wanna go for it today, I think that it's important. I want to start this argument with a hypothesis that there's a link between Pennebaker's research. Pennebaker was the one who did the journaling studies, where they found that if you journal, paradoxically, your autonomic nervous system spikes up, right? You feel more stress when you've journaled. But then after journaling, you go down to a point that's even lower. Your autonomic nervous system stress goes down to a point that's lower than the baseline before you journaled. And the same thing is true with humor. Humor is a crossing of a line. We're like, oh, should we be laughing at this? When we cross that line, we experience a spike, but also we see moments we come down to a point that's much more relaxed. I've had terrible days, horrible days where everything seems to go wrong. But then at some point during the day, I've recognized that too many things have gone wrong in one day, right? It crosses that line, and suddenly all the bad things that have occurred during that day seem absurd and therefore humorous, right? You start laughing at how ridiculously bad your day has become. The movement towards laughter as catharsis has taken off. And you've seen laughing groups in India, which are similar to the cuddle groups in New York. I think this is a New Yorker article where people just get together and they'll cuddle, right? So that people feel contact with each other. They can't do anything, they just cuddle. It's beautiful. It's similar to the laughing groups in India, where people will get together, they'll sit in a circle, and then one person will laugh. They'll force a laugh, they'll go, ha ha ha. Or however they would laugh. And then they would go around in the circle, and they would ha ha ha, and they would all laugh, and they would force something until everyone in the room is laughing spontaneously, and therefore experiencing all the benefits of therapy. Watch how the lens can change even when we're watching a horror clip. I love this part, and it doesn't quite work as well if you haven't seen the movie. How many people have seen The Shining? Oh, okay, good. Okay, more than I expected. The Shining is a terrifying movie. I played a clip of it last night online. It's just a trailer, and nothing happens in the trailer. It's just the music from the movie, and I was terrified. Look it up online. It might have been because it was 4 a.m, but like I was terribly frightened. What happens in the movie is Jack Nicholson, and he and his wife and his very young son go off, and they have to stay in a really large cabin-like lodge where hundreds of people normally stay during the summer, but they have to close it for the winter so they can't get out. And so they go to stay there so he can work on his writing. So over the course of the movie, you find out that Jack Nicholson is at least crazy, but maybe also demonic, as he becomes an axe murderer, attempts to kill his children. They all experience feelings of cabin fever. The little boy has epileptic seizures where he sees blood flying in, and he's talking to his hand, and his hand helps him think about, like, recognize that he's in danger because they're living in this place where the devil is walking around, and it's terribly frightening, and it doesn't quite make sense outside of this, but there's parts in it where he's writing on the wall backwards. He writes murder backwards on the wall, and it's because children can't necessarily conceive of some ideas themselves, and so he's standing there holding a terrible, like, long knife while his mother's sleeping, writing murder on the wall because he recognizes his father's gone too far. You find out at one point, this last part I'll tell you, you find out one part that he's been typing the whole time, getting angrier and angrier, right, because he's writing the story, and then you finally get to see the page, and on every single page of stacks and stacks, it just says something like, all work and no play make Jack a very dull boy, over and over and over again. Frightening, scary, terrifying. They're demonic twins, everything. Scary movie? Here's a retelling of it. Here's a preview for the movie through the lens of humor.
Meet Jack Torrance.
I'm outlining a new writing project.
He's a writer looking for inspiration.
Lots of ideas. Some good ones.
Meet Danny. He's a kid looking for a dad.
There's hardly anybody to play with around here.
What's up, Doc?
Jack just can't finish his book.
I don't want to sound melodramatic, but there's no way to make it economically feasible.
Here's to 5 miserable months.
But now, sometimes, what we need the most is just around the corner.
I'm your new foster brother.
I'd do anything.
Climbing up on Salisbury Hill.
I love it.
shiny.
I love that. I wish you could enjoy as much as I do. Watch the movie, then watch the clip again. It's fantastic. The point of that is that we can make the world less scary by just changing the lens through which we view it. Think about the ways in which they took a horror thing, like a nuclear holocaust, and changed it into movie Dr. Strangelove. It was originally, the plot is originally a serious book about the dangers of the nuclear war. And through a different lens, they find something humorous and something that's terrifying. There's a critic called Elliot Oering. Oering talks about how humor is therapy. The humor allows us to deal with the tragic. In it, in his paper, he cites jokes about the Challenger explosion. There's also jokes that you've heard probably about Hurricane Katrina, about September 11th, about the tsunami. Even the Onion newspaper came out a week after September 11th and came out with an article about September 11th. How could people laugh at tragedy? Well, for all the reasons I think I mentioned before, that laughter allows a certain level of power dynamic over what is being laughed at. We cannot necessarily change the world, the alpha press, but we can change how we view it and respond to it. Instead of responding at only terror at death, we can laugh at the tragedy, at the suffering, and in doing so, momentarily elevate ourselves above it, knowing that we'll get through it. Now, I want to show you something that I think is very powerful, and I think that it's very challenging. And I don't see it as a buzz killer, but actually a sobering realization of how powerful humor is. I'm going to show you a clip from Jon Stewart, who I think is the funniest person in America. He's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And it's him the week after September 11th. And he's trying to return to the show. And watch as a character study, watch his hands, watch his motions, watch his face, watch him attempt to try and come up with humor and then recoil back, and attempt to come out and recoil back. Watch him almost as he breathes, but also think about what he's attempting to do as a comedian.
And welcome to The Daily Show. We are back. This is our first show since the tragedy in New York City. And there's no other way really to start the show than to ask you at home the question that we asked the audience here tonight and that we've asked everybody that we know here in New York since September 11th, and that is, are you okay? And we pray that you are and that your family is. I'm sorry to do this to you. It's another entertainment show beginning with an overwrought speech of a shaken host. And television is nothing if not redundant. So I apologize for that. It's something that unfortunately we do for ourselves so that we can drain whatever abscess is in our hearts and move on to the business of making you laugh, which we haven't been able to do very effectively lately. Everyone's checked in already. I know we're late. I'm sure we're getting in right under the wire before the cast of Survivor offers their insight into what to do in these situations. They said to get back to work, and there were no jobs available for a man in the fetal position under his desk crying, which I gladly would have taken. So I come back here, tonight's show is not obviously a regular show. We looked through the vault. We found some clips that we thought might make you smile. Which is really what's necessary, I think, right about now. And a lot of folks have asked me, what are you going to do when you get back? What are you going to say? I mean, that, geez, what a terrible thing to have to do, and I don't see it as a burden at all. I see it as a privilege, and I see it as a privilege, and everyone here does see it that way. And
I think it's extraordinary and sober. It makes me sad every time I watch it. But I think that there's something amazing about what he's attempting to do. Extraordinary, where you try and heal after a tragedy. And part of the way he does that is by recognizing that humor does have some sort of benefits. But you can see that he's trying to laugh and has to keep coming back away from it. I think one of the things that makes this so powerful, even The Onion came out, when it came out after September 11th, they said it was the most painful thing that they had ever done and they would never do it again. And it's partly because they recognized how hard it was for them to do this, to attempt to change and transform reality through humor. But I think that there are ways of doing it. And I want to show you a clip from Family Guy, which is on the reverse side of this. Which I think is really interesting. And the more I watch it, the more brilliant I think it is, because watch how it attempts to slowly transform us from the fear that we're actually experiencing. Remember, at the fear of everything that we are worried about, even where death becomes absurd. Watch what Family Guy does in terms of slowly moving us away from that so that the joke goes on too long. It's what Family Guy does, right? But part of the way that they do this is they try to slowly move you so that you are able to laugh at the situation, and watch, the best part of it is, instead of making fun of the situation, it humanizes the situation.
This is a message to all American infidels. Prepare to die in a sea of holy fire. You will be punished for your decadent ways on the first day of Radaman. You... wait a minute, did I just say, what did I say, Radaman? Ramadan. Radaman, what is that? Yeah, maybe Dennis Radaman is going to punish you with his crazy hair. No? What's that? Right, yeah, no. Okay, let's go again. Okay. This is a message to all Americans. I'm not going to be able to do it now. I got to get all the laughs out. Okay, all right.
Today's
stop making that face over there. What are you doing? I can't. He makes that face and it makes me laugh. Okay, you know what? Just turn around. Turn around. I don't care where you look. Just look over there. Okay. All right, they're cracking up over there. Okay. Oh, yeah, look who's snickering over there. Mister, I can't do a suicide bombing because I'm sick. He had a note from his doctor. He brought a note from his doctor. It's a suicide bombing. What are you... Okay, all right, here we go. This is going to get all serious now, okay. Death to... I can't do it. Oh, come on, now you're just trying to make... Hey, wait. Look at the rubber chicken, you know? I just do like the whole tape with this in my hand, you know? Just totally like with the chicken right here, because everyone would be like, what the hell? What is...
Death to Americans!
Just let him do it.
It actually goes on from there, but part of what I want to show you is the extraordinary courage it takes to laugh in the face of tragedy. But what I'm talking about today is that humor has extraordinary power, but it also demands extraordinary levels of courage, like Jon Stewart getting up after September 11th and trying to heal the nation through the power of humor. We know that humor is a lens, just like optimism, that demands a mindfulness to potentialities, that increases health, increases sociability, and decreases stress. That humor is therapy and performs and causes us to feel different levels of transcendence. And we know the power that humor can hold to change reality. Humor is the key to recognizing and inventing, if only momentarily, a better world than the status quo, for the purpose of increasing our health, increasing our bonds and friendship, and increasing our abilities to not only adapt to reality, but to make reality adaptive. And just like Jon Stewart said that it's a privilege to do this, I felt the same way. Thank you for being such a great audience.